This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark here. I'm joined here with Matthew Pegas. He blogs at altofcenter.com. Matthew, great to have you on the show.
Great talking to you too, Robert. It's a real privilege to be on the show.
Thanks. And just to give kind of some background information of how you discovered the show and about how your views kind of came to be, is you discovered this show via the show I did with Juju and James Stewart,
yeah.
And that totally transformed your entire life.
Pretty much. I mean, it set me off on the trajectory to transform my entire worldview, for sure. Basically, my background is I used to be a leftist, pretty in college. I studied a lot of the kind of critical theory, of the sort that, you know, like Kevin McDonald talks about, for instance. And that still has influenced me a lot, but I kind of switched sides of the... Well, I don't even like to necessarily think of things in terms of the political spectrum, but sort of, in some sense, switched sides around the time that I heard the show with Jamie Stewart, yeah.
And what in particular about the show, what topics and themes really connected with you?
For the Juju show?
Well, that show and just in general, how it changed your worldview.
Yeah. So, trying to think where to start the story. But basically, Juju is my favorite band. Still is my favorite band. And had been a sort of transgressive, very queer, I would say, act that I'd really felt drawn to at the certain period of my life that I was in. Again, this was about 6 months ago, so it's kind of the period of my life that I'm still in. But I just felt very drawn to it because I was kind of in a isolated place in my life. Had recently gone through a large breakup and was drawn towards kind of darker art type stuff. Darker, more transgressive art, and stuff that explored a sort of gay identity or a queer identity, but with a really transgressive spin on it. And of course, at the time, this was all in the part and parcel of a very leftist worldview that I had. And then one night, I was making dinner. I was just looking for Jamie Stewart interviews in general on YouTube, and I found the one that you and Pilleader did. And there was nothing particularly politically dissident about that interview for most of it, but then Pilleader said something about Asian-Aryanism at the end, and I pretty much went to his YouTube account at that and fell down the rabbit hole. I kind of found really identified with Pilleader a lot as someone who was a lot like me in terms of his interests.
And you've actually met him in person.
I have actually met him in person, which was kind of just because I live in California and he lives in Philadelphia. But we ended up just really by chance, honestly. I was in Philadelphia when he performed as Feven Universe at the Sound Hole, so we did meet. So that was pretty cool, and we've been talking for a while. He's the one I first started talking to about 3 weeks after hearing that show. I sent him an email, you know, like, "Oh man, Pilleader, like." yeah, I mean, I said I don't necessarily like this meme, but I was like, "Oh, you red-pilled me, blah blah blah." I think I said that he kind of created a a renaissance of sorts in my mind, because he had, I mean, once after breaking away from the kind of leftist worldview and realizing that some of the artistic stuff that I was into could be part of a kind of alternative, more conservative worldview, it really revolutionized my take on a lot of things and also my approach to my work.
Well, I'm just looking over your blog, Alt of Center, and it's pretty much basically all the themes that I talk about on my show.
Yeah, that's a good point. I feel like that probably should be acknowledged. That you know, I could kind of like pretend that I had all these thoughts independently, or that I'm just coming from some other place, and they just so happen to overlap with stuff on this show. But the reality is that I am extremely influenced by your show. So in some ways, I'm kind of just not parroting, because I'm not like copying it per se, but just interpreting what I've heard on your show through my own lens. So I would definitely identify pretty fully as a Starkian.
Oh yeah, I think it was that blogger Arian Skynet who reviewed book Journey to Vapor Island, and he coined the term a Starkian, and I guess I have to take a lot of pride in that, because I've taken a lot of time for my kind of views to evolve and my identity to evolve. And there was this period where I was just a guy who interviewed people. And now I've kind of like reached this point where I have a strong identity, to the point where people can say, like, this is a Starkian philosophy, or this is a Starkian aesthetic.
Yeah. I feel like that with my blog, and it's all kind of coinciding with the book On Your Legacy that Pillater just released. I think we're kind of reaching a sort of a meta moment with the show, maybe.
So your blog is called Alt of Center, and that's a reference to this concept called the Alt Center. I'm doing a lot of Google searches for the Alt Center, and I'm hearing mainstream people like picking up on that term.
But yeah.
The Alt Center kind of evolved as a, I wouldn't say, it's not really alt-right, but it sort of combines aspects of the alt-right with aspects of the left. I mean, that's kind of a very simplistic way to put it.
But yeah, no, I see what you mean, though. Yeah, I think I don't really think it's like an ideology. I think it just kind of describes a certain moment that maybe we're entering into where, as I put it on my blog, like, I kind of think of the alt-center as a kind of post-alt-right movement almost. Not that the alt-right is necessarily dead, but I think we're at a point where a lot of the ideas have been disseminated to a lot of people, and people are kind of having interesting interpretations of those ideas, and synthesizing them with other points of view.
And in your post, Beyond Liberalism, A Political New Wave, you make the analogy that the alt center is to the alt right when new wave was to punk.
Yeah, I mean, that's me. I just like to think in kind of aesthetic metaphors sometimes, but I like that image. That was kind of one of the metaphors that came to me that made me want to start a blog, because I definitely wanted to lean into the aesthetics of it all. And I just kind of had that idea of, just given my understanding of, you know, the way kind of rebellion can happen in society when, you know, prevailing hegemonies are rebelled against. There's kind of an initial point that is very chaotic or angry in the way that punk is, and I think sometimes the energy from that can be then taken and synthesized into something that's a little more, again, we're just speaking in metaphors here, but a little more harmonious, a little more, with a little bit more of that kind of traditional conservative focus on beauty as opposed to just like, fuck the system or whatever.
So a big part of it is not just politics, but you kind of create this like ideal aesthetic cultural vision, and that kind of, in an esoteric way, attracts the kind of people who would connect to that. And, I mean, someone could share your aesthetic taste and have totally polar opposite political views, but I do think there is something in the human subconscious where creating this visual imagery and this subculture based on aesthetics and culture will bring together people who share, like, the sort of a similar psyche or philosophical outlook.
Yeah, I think so. And I think we're kind of reaching a point in the history of the West, not to speak too grandly about it, where people are really mistrusting the kind of grand narratives in a very postmodern way, whether they're, you know, initially all the old conservative narratives were kind of deconstructed. I think we're also kind of reaching a point where ideas like egalitarianism and liberal universalism are also, people are starting to mistrust those narratives too. And I think it's this kind of Nietzschean moment where we start to mistrust the kind of constructions of language by which we you know, configured ourselves to the idea of truth. And I think at that moment, aesthetics become a lot more important and becomes about, you know, what kind of existentially can move you, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, for sure. The image that you use, it for some reason, it reminds me of that film, Mishima, Life in Four Chapters. I don't know if that was intentional.
Oh yeah? I mean, I love that movie, and Mishima, I would say, is perhaps my biggest influence in a lot of ways. You mean the one on the Beyond Liberalism post?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, it definitely channels that kind of, I guess, Asian or even Asian-Aryan aesthetic of that movie with the little pot I put there. But, yeah.
So you have this post putting the neon into neon nationalism.
Yeah,
I think
nationalism,
it was actually it was Brandon Adamson who coined that term to describe the ideology of Roger Blackstone.
And neon nationalism.
Yeah, Brandon.
Interesting.
Adamson coined
that. Yeah, yeah.
He coined that term on the show. Yeah.
Huh. I don't know if I missed that or I'm just remembering it subconsciously or something, but I thought I came up with that, which is, I'm not saying that to take credit for it. I just think it's interesting that we perhaps both stumbled upon that idea.
And it also kind of ties into the whole concept of, if you listen to that show I did with Ashley Messinger, and he wrote this article on altleft.com, and I basically kind of, he wrote it, but I kind of told him what to write about, and basically
yeah, yeah.
It's the I'm kind of doing that with you now. I like to do that. I like to boss people around and tell them, like, you got to write about this. So basically what that is like Roger Blackstone's political ideology is based very much on aesthetics.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what neon nationalism is it's basing a political ideology on an aesthetic vision. And Roger Blackstone, that character, he actually puts out this whole political platform which is very geared towards aesthetics, but that's a major theme of your article.
Absolutely. I mean, again, it was very influenced by this show, and I did hear that show you did with Ashley Messinger, and even very influenced by Journey to Vapor Island and Blackstone. But it also corresponded with ideas that I'd been kind of kicking around for a while, even when I was more of a leftist. I was interested in this concept called metamodernism. Are you familiar with it?
No.
Yeah, it's kind of still this mostly just like on the internet idea, I think, or maybe in some European universities it gets some attention, but it's a sort of post-postmodernism. Sorry to get into like the academic claptrap. I know probably a lot of people listening to this don't want to hear that, but this is kind of the background I come from. So it's kind of a post-postmodern movement which seeks to mediate between elements of modernism and postmodernism, and in which the role of aesthetics is kind of championed in a new way. again, kind of going back to what I was saying before, I think the idea, and again, I acknowledge this is very much coming from a leftist academic kind of view of things, but the idea is that postmodernism has kind of deconstructed all of the, you know, the old myths of you know, nationhood, etc., how we came to be, and we're at this point in the culture where that kind of postmodernism is not just in the academy, but it's kind of pervaded all of society and created this kind of atomization. And then the important question is what comes next. And to me, the idea of metamodernism is almost, you know, we have to pick the myth that best suits our time. We have to lean into creativity and aesthetics as a means by which to go forward, rather than looking for, you know, transcendent truth or whatever.
I think a lot of people would hear neo-nationalism and the first thing they would think of is a fast wave.
Yeah, definitely. I'm definitely a big fan of the genre, and that's, I think, pretty much the core of the aesthetic.
So what you're saying is what you envision is you advocate a nationalism not based so much on ethnicity, religion, or the traditional concept of the nation, such as like American patriotism, but nationalism based on an aesthetic. So that's very esoteric. And
it's still a little bit vague, I would
say.
Yeah,
vague and abstract. But I think it can kind of lead to, if you think about things in a very utopian sense, like actually building societies and countries around a shared aesthetic, and that's, throughout history, that's obviously, like, the Roman Empire, obviously ancient Rome had a very clear aesthetic.
Yeah, yeah.
And European countries in different eras, the different, the United States in different periods. But no one, that's actually never been done, basing a national identity purely on aesthetics. That's a very revolutionary idea.
Yeah, I suppose it is. And I mean, I think usually, I'm not a historian, but I would say usually aesthetics kind of evolve out of other things, you know, out of utilitarian needs, etc. That's how a lot of nations would develop their aesthetics. But we're in this internet era where we can kind of just create aesthetics in the abstract and kind of get people to rally behind them. And part of the point I was trying to make is not only like that's kind of an idea, a revolutionary idea for the future, but also I think that to acknowledge the role that has played in recent politics, like with the alt-right, etc., in terms of converting people, you know, with memes and genres like fast wave, just kind of making you know, your movement seem very appealing, existentially and aesthetically appealing, is what I think wins a lot more people over than simply convincing them what you're saying is true.
So you talk about an archaeo-futurist subculture. You use that term, or retro-futurist subculture too, that is so aesthetically pleasing that it can outcompete liberal universalism and global capitalism. Because the thing, I mean, if you look at liberal universalism and global capitalism, I think they've sort of lost that grand aesthetic vision. Maybe they did in the past. If you look at capitalism, if you look at the sort of Art Deco era of the 20s and 30s, or you look at the aesthetics of the 1980s, and those, or even our mid-century modern, there were these different eras, but we've gotten to a point in history where the sort of, where both the liberal order and the capitalist order, because basically our society is ruled by a coalition of liberals and capitalists, and those two groups have pretty much failed to provide a grand, like a grand aesthetic vision.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree.
And I mean, that's even how you were attracted to the show, because even with Juju, in some ways they do associate with the left, but they're not part of like the mainstream left culture. They're basically avant-garde.
Yeah, and this is in the article I wrote on homo nationalism. I kind of touch on this as well, or maybe I should have touched on it more. But I think there's something about transgressive art that kind of transcends politics. I would say Juju is pretty left wing, or has aligned itself with that. I mean, if you go to their Bandcamp page, like, they donate all their proceeds to, like, Black Lives Matter and NACLU. Yet there's still this kind of transgressive character that I think totally defies any kind of political spectrum, really. It's kind of a thing in and of itself that right now I think has is more aligned with the right than the left.
Did you see the original show with Jamie Stewart, or the one we did of Fritcher Wollstonecroft?
I listened to both. Yeah.
Yeah, that was funny because Jamie hates the alt-right, and like Richard, it was like for the alt-right.
Yeah, no, I remember the tension there. I always wondered, like, how much Jamie knew that your show was. Not that this, I don't really think this is an alt-right show.
No,
it's but not. Yeah. I always wondered how much he knew that it was ever kind of associated with it, though, because he definitely was pretty strong-worded in his dismissal.
Oh yeah, he was.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you do reference the kind of futurist aesthetic of Brandon Adamson, and this whole kind of scene, it's like a movement of artists. So, Brandon Adamson, he provides a very clear visual aesthetic.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I do that in a number of ways. So, I'm a painter, so I do that with my artwork. I do that with my photography. And I even do that with those, like, kind of crude collages I make on a PixelR editor that I use for my show posts.
Oh, yeah, I didn't realize that you made those. That's cool.
And my book, basically, I describe the architecture in the book and the visual imagery probably as graphic as I describe the sex scenes.
Yeah, that's a good comparison. It's kind of all, it's an extremely visual book. It's very much bears the mark of something written by someone who also paints, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, this may sound weird, but I totally find like art and architecture to be erotic.
Yeah, no, that's that makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's the kind of thing I think about a lot too. I mean, they always say it's a cliche, but how, you know, buildings in and of themselves are phallic. And there's obviously some kind of truth to that.
Oh, yeah, like the scene where Ivan say Gnome gets a massive erection thinking about all the grand aesthetic visions that are being implemented.
Yeah, yeah. No, I guess that kind of ties into another thing I say about my blog. In the very first post I ever made, titled Introduction, I think of my blog, and I kind of think of the Starkian thing, too, and you can disavow if you want. I think of it as an exploration of, or at least sometimes an exploration of, the connections between politics, aesthetics, and sexuality. Because I definitely think all of those things are deeply interconnected. I mean, for me, they're not separate spheres of my life. They're all really the same. I'm speaking in abstractions and kind of esoterically here, so I apologize for that, but definitely that has been kind of a core staple of my worldview, even when I was a leftist.
Well, that's basically what my book's pretty much about, how all those issues connect. Totally get it.
Yeah.
So you wrote The Alt of Center Guide to Aesthetic Warfare?
Yeah.
What was that? That's basically on the same theme.
Yeah, I mean, that post and the neon nationalism post could probably be one post. It's also the post where I kind of define what I think of as the sort of alt-left idea that this podcast presents. I think...
Well, we have so many words now. we have the alt-left, we have the left wing of the alt-right, and the alt-center.
Yeah, so, well, it gets confusing because, various people keep kind of reappropriating things. I mean, I think alt-left was kind of dead in the water. I hate to be that fatalistic, but it definitely took a massive blow when Trump referred to Antifa as the alt-left. That made it kind of hard to continue using it after when he did that on national television. But yeah, I think alt-center, again, not as a rigidly defined term, but and that's also why I say alt-of-center as opposed to alt-center. I don't necessarily want to expound a specific dogma. I just kind of want to convey the idea of being a alternative of center, I suppose.
Kind of so like anyway, how Brandon said his blog is left of the alt-right instead of left, the left wing of the alt-right. It's left of the alt-right.
That's right. It makes it so it's a little harder to pin it down.
So this is a total Starkian, but you say that the whole scene, whether you want to call it alt-left or alt-center, it's on one hand it's opposed to liberal universalism and globalism in the same way that the broader alt-right is.
Yeah, but I think every bit as much.
Yeah, there's also this kind of cultural interest in things like indie rock, modernist architecture, and socially progressive causes such as environmentalism, transhumanism, and basic income.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kind of think of it as these things were kind of hegemonically tied to liberalism for decades, but I think we're living in a transitional era right now where that hegemony is kind of coming undone a little bit. I mean, I think a lot of people would have seen the connection between a lot of those, you know, just the idea of progressivism in the abstract is like very much tied to this egalitarian ideal. But I think we may be living in an era where the connection between that is shown to be not so natural, but rather the product of social and economic domination, which is slipping away.
And this scene is different than the traditional populist right. The traditional populist right was very much a rural working class movement. Then you move on to the alt-right, and it's a little more white-collar to suburban. And then this scene we're talking about has a very strong component to it that is middle to upper middle class, urban, and SWPL. And these are people who are from that background who would stereotypically be seen as liberals, but they're starting to become aware of all these problems that the alt-right is addressing. And because basically there's all this tension in society with demographic change and economic strife, but at the same time they're still holding on to the sort of positive aspects of the left.
Yeah, sort of holding on to a baseline progressive vision while addressing the realities of the negative effects that liberal universalism has had.
And you reference how globalization has traditionally harmed the working class, but then you reference something like the H-1B visas in the Silicon Valley, which have a strong negative impact on the college-educated middle to upper middle class. And you reference the interview I did with Kevin Lin of Progressives for Immigration Reform, which totally relates to what we're talking about.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think more and more kind of that SWPL class is realizing that they've been kind of fucked over in a lot of ways. And a lot of it does have to do with global capitalism. So there is a left-wing aspect of it. But there's also, I think, a kind of dawning consciousness of how this sort of liberal egalitarianism that is shoved down our throats by the culture is very much has become is used in the service of global capitalism to kind of provide a moral veneer for its activities.
And hopefully this is going to be like a a new groundbreaking scene, something that will catch on. But even though that the... I mean, I think we're doing something that's new and different than the alt-right. But yeah. Even someone like Richard Spencer, he has some aspects of this. Like, he's into some Swipple cultural stuff, and Richard Spencer did come out in support of a basic income. So yeah. Richard Spencer has a lot of those qualities, but the thing about Richard Spencer is, despite that, he has to cater to a very kind of right-wing audience.
Yeah, I mean, he found his audience at a certain time when it was still sort of coming out of the far right, but I think we're entering an era now where there is this kind of alt-center sort of foaming up. As you said, when you Google it, you do find people talking about this idea. And yeah, I mean, the way I think of it, again, still kind of working out what exactly the alt-center would be, but I think of it as a kind of, it has the kind of big tent elements that the alt-right has, where it can attract people from different backgrounds, potentially different, you know, ethnicities and ways of life, etc. But at the same time, it's more quote-unquote based, as it were. It's kind of, I think of it as kind of an alternative to both the alt-right and the alt-right, because it takes insights from the alt-right, but also from the left.
So you wrote about homo nationalism. I like your parody of the 14 words, because of the white Aryan man must not perish from the earth.
Definitely pretty trolly, which I may come to regret, but yeah. No, and I think homo nationalism is related to the overall project. I don't know if you have some questions about what it is first.
Who coined that term? Because when I first heard it, I thought it was something that like you and Pillator came up with as a joke. But then I actually did a Google search, and Wikipedia has an entry on it, and it's
It's the Wikipedia entry is something that that's not my idea of it, and but I think Pillator actually was the one who started using homo nationalism in the sense that I use it to describe a kind of phenomenon coming out of certain countercurrents writers. So I think it's more Pillator's term, and I just kind of went along with it, but there's also a previously defined version that you can find on Wikipedia, which was a queer studies professor at Rutgers used it to kind of define basically xenophobia directed towards homophobic cultures. You know, Milo Yiannopoulos would be seen as one of the sort of preachers of that type of homo nationalism. But I think the way that Pillator and I use it has to do with a much, I think, much deeper and more interesting phenomenon that comes a lot out of James J. O'Mara's book, The Homo and the Negro, which situates, which kind of gives a rundown of the history of not even necessarily homosexuality, but homoeroticism in the history of the West and the Aryan race. And kind of points to all the ways in which homoeroticism has been kind of a deep part of a lot of cultures.
I mean, he doesn't use the term aristocratic radical, but he basically makes that case that the homosexual is sort of the natural aristocratic radical, the creator of culture, the person who doesn't conform to the norms of society, but sort of sets the new cultural trends.
Yeah, and that would be my position as well. And I think it's to me, it's very clear that when you start to look and think about the role that a lot of homosexuals have played in civilizations, that there really is something to that view, that given that they're not kind of beholden to the demands they don't want to, you know, have a family and kind of apply their erotic energies to that, they rather gravitate towards art and kind of maybe even identify with the broader community as a family more than, you know, their own personal family, and in so doing become the creators of civilization and also the preservers of civilization. And they play a sort of shamanic or priestly role within civilizations.
Yeah, I think that's pretty pretty accurate.
Yeah. So that, I mean, that there, I kind of differentiate that. I mean, that's kind of the groundwork for a kind of gay conservatism, which, again, the other aspect of it, as argued by O'Mara, is, you know, the American right, and probably much of the European right too, has been very homophobic due to interpretations of Christianity, and so it kind of made a very bad move in forfeiting the kind of cultural creating powers of gays, and instead they've been kind of co-opted, or not co-opted, but appropriated by the left and kind of used as a tool of destruction against civilization.
So one of O'Mara's key theories is that his reasoning why the right wing has become so anti-intellectual and driven out all the creative types, because there's basically, I can't think of a single like prominent like artist or filmmaker who's done anything really avant-garde who's a conservative. And James O'Mara believes the root cause of that is because the right wing drove out the homosexual.
Yeah, and I mean, I think to me the truth of that is just very self-evident. But I mean, the good news, I think, is that that's changing. And while there are still a lot of very, you know, anti-gay elements within the alt-right, I think there is a kind of an implicit acceptance of, you know, different kinds of aesthetics and more kind of avant-garde art that comes out of those communities, and a recognition of the value of that.
So you referenced these artists, Danish filmmaker Lasse Nielsen and photographer Will McBride, basically.
Yeah.
Normies and closed-minded reactionary types will flip out just by the fact that we know that these individuals even exist. But I don't really care, because I think they are relevant to culture. Mm-hmm. And Lasse Nielsen is a Danish filmmaker who made he made some gay-themed films as well as a few straight films in Denmark in the 1970s and 80s. And Will McBride is this photographer. He's a art photographer who... He did a art photo coffee table book of an elite boarding school in Germany.
Yeah.
And the reason that they're kind of culturally relevant figures is because there is this kind of irony that they are products of this kind of leftist gay counterculture that was really big in the 70s. It was very much a libertine subculture. Today's left today's left is no longer libertine, but
no,
they're sort of a product of that sexual libertine culture. But the kind of aesthetic and society that they portray, it's very traditional, kind of a focus. There's a theme of a male bonding. And then there's also the aspect of a society that is like culturally and ethnically homogenous.
Yeah, very homogenous.
Yeah, in places like Germany or Denmark. And Pilliter and I kind of used to joke that a lot of these gay white nationalists, like, this is like their utopian society.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what it looks like in a lot of ways. But I really think there's something to, it's not something I know a terrible amount about, but I mean, there's something about the idea that in more homogenous or anyways less degenerated or atomized societies, there's this more natural, even familial bond between people, and thereby there's a kind of more natural place for homoeroticism within the society, rather than in an atomized society where everything is kind of reduced to the lowest common denominator, so it's all, you know, gay sex this, gay sex that, without these kind of more aesthetically interesting rituals like the group shower. But it's not, I'm not an expert on this, but it's definitely an interesting, it's an interesting view, and it's also, the shock value is definitely quite enjoyable, because, you know, you're not really supposed to talk about this if you're pro-gay, because you're supposed to be very liberal, but you're also not supposed to talk about this if you're on the right, because you're supposed to be anti-gay, and it's kind of this interesting intersection.
Yeah, it's an interesting intersection, because it, on one hand, I guess you were saying that it's taboo on both sides. It's degenerate to the conservatives, but too traditionalist for the left.
Yeah, exactly. Which is, for me, that these ideas are kind of related to that aristocratic elitism or aristocratic radicalism ideal that you explore on your show, because the view that starts to emerge, I think, is that some of these kind of degenerate things, quote-unquote, like ideas about homosexuality or other kinds of paraphilias, are things that, you know, they're elements of, like, human experience and knowledge that we should know about, but while simultaneously acknowledging that if these things are kind of spread out to the whole of society, taught in schools, treated as normal, it's really bad. So it's kind of both views at once. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. Another thing you reference is the Steve Saylor article from the UNS Review, Students Still Sweat, They Just Don't Shower. And that ties in with the whole kind of Nielsen McBride aesthetic, because, I mean, I remember when I was in high school, I mean, I went to a high school that was, it was kind of ghetto in L.A., and we had this old defunct shower that wasn't even being used. But I think there's sort of three reasons why there's been a decline in that. There's a kind of atomization of society, where people, there's less male bonding. People want their kind of a close social space or personal space. There is the kind of sexual hysterias, either, well, there's a hysteria because there's the whole kind of all these sexual hang-ups. And then the other thing is society is a lot more ethnically diverse, and I think when you have a homogenous society, people feel more comfortable doing stuff like that together.
Definitely, and there's just this kind of unconscious element to it all. Things just kind of happen in an organic way, based on principles of, like, what I would call a sort of natural wisdom about the ways different kind of erotic energies should be sort of sublimated within a hierarchical society. And then what you get with atomization is the kind of hyper-conceptualization of everything, where everything has a name and a label on it, and we're all paranoid, and there's nothing organic about the way we live. I don't know if that made sense, but that also, I would say, ties into the idea of then a politics of aesthetics, because it's an idea of a kind of post-conceptual politics. I don't know if I'm just going off on a tangent here. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. I mean, you don't have to be gay and want to go out and, like, have sex with a man, but you can appreciate, like, an aesthetically pleasing male form.
Definitely. Well, you should be able to, but, you know, when if we live in a society where it's all you know, homosexual, gay this, gay that, then it's kind of put more in a box, again, reduced to the lowest common denominator of just being a sex act.
I think you said this somewhere on your blog in reference to how our culture, in certain aspects, has become degenerate, and then in certain aspects, it's neo-puritanical, but you described it as the Nietzschean concept of Christianity as a slave morality, but without the positive benefits of Christianity?
Yeah, definitely. It's this kind of completely, well, not completely anymore, but unstated, in some cases unconscious, holding on to this moral principle of egalitarianism, basically for its own sake, and kind of devoid of any of the transcendence which moral ideas were given in Christianity. It just becomes this aestheticless, mechanical, hyper sort of rationality, which is applied to everything and used to deconstruct it. Which is, I think that's why, you know, for the longest time, the left and liberalism were associated with artists. And I think that's one of the major things that's been breaking down over the past few years, is there's this democratization of art where nothing can offend anybody. And
do you also say something about Aleister Crowley and the Marquis de Sade in that essay?
Yeah, I do reference both of them. Definitely playing into the kind of aristocratic elitist ideal for sure, but also the idea of a certain kind of libertinism that is a rebellion against a totalitarianism of rationality, is I think what I said. And I do view liberal universalism as having entered into a totalitarian phase where it reduces everything to these categories of oppression and doesn't leave space outside for free aesthetic expression. And I think people on the right or of the right are now kind of retaking a lot of that cultural space with their memes, etc.
Oh, and in your essay on neo-nationalism, you reference a lot of those memes. Like, you even reference Chatelet, which...
Yeah.
That's my book.
Yeah, it is, yeah. I think that's... I remember when I first got a quote-unquote red-pilled, I found Chatelet on YouTube, a vaporwave video someone had done for it, and I was just like, wow, this stuff is pretty top quality. And kind of realized that the right was really kicking the shit out of the left in terms of aesthetics.
Are there aspects of homo nationalism in my book?
I would say for sure. I mean, you have Noam, who I think you've said in previous podcasts is bisexual, although he kind of sometimes chalks it up to more of
hint at Will McBride. I don't know if you picked that up, but do you remember the scene where Noam sneaks into the study of like a gay photographer and steals his work?
I remember that scene. I was just rereading the book. I mean, I first read it like, you know, 4 months ago or so, and then I was rereading it before doing the show and while I was posting my stuff on my blog. And there was a lot that I picked up on that I, having explored other art like McBride and Nielsen, that I wouldn't have picked up before. No. There's also a reference to boarding schools, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. The old British boarding school rituals.
That could have been the one in Kaze Tokino Uta, the one that Pill Eater likes, the Japanese manga. But
yeah.
With Noam, he's a racist homo-nationalist because he talks about how having to take a shower in this like ghetto public school and how disgusting it is, and he has this idealized vision of the male aesthetic he wants to appreciate. So he takes his like bisexual leanings, and it's very kind of racialized and aestheticized.
Yeah, definitely. No, I would say Vapor Island is I don't know if I would call it a homo nationalist book, but it definitely has a strong theme of that throughout.
It's another homo nationalist, it's neon nationalist, it's everything you want it to be.
It's pretty much it's pretty much a lot of things that my blog covers.
Or there's also the theme. Oh, there's also the theme with Noam's obsession with blonde Jewish girls. But I was just kind of thinking of that because. You did that photo that made me think of that photo journal you did of Ventura Boulevard.
Oh, yeah, because there's a lot of blonde Jewish women on Ventura, huh?
Yeah. But I see you forgot to take a picture of that that neon clown in North Hollywood at Circus Liquor that was featured in Clueless with Alicia Silverstone.
You know, I haven't seen Clueless or that clown, but it's definitely something I'll check out.
But a lot of your photographs, they're mostly of old vintage neon signs that were from the kind of mid-centuries, 50s to 60s era on Ventura Boulevard?
Yeah. Yeah, I just kind of walked up the boulevard and shot what I saw in terms of neon. but yeah, a lot of really interesting mid-century neon aesthetics.
And then you also have all those 80s mini malls.
Yeah, I've just, you mentioned that to me over Messenger, and I've started to, I never really thought of those as like a distinctive thing, but ever since you woke me up to it, like I've noticed all those 80s mini malls like all up and down the boulevard. It's interesting. You're talking about like the kind of like multi-level structures that like strip malls, but more compact and with multiple levels.
Those are the ones.
Yeah. They're interesting, all right. Yeah. So I might do another...
Like these interesting features, like maybe they'll have like a Roman column, and then a clock, and then some kind of neon, and...
Yeah, there's a lot of weird kind of postmodern amalgamations of different time periods in the architecture. I might do another series just about the Galleria on Ventura Boulevard in Sherman Oaks.
Well, the original one from the 80s was demolished. I mean, I do have memories of going there as a kid, but I don't really have like a vivid... it was so long ago, I don't really have a vivid imagery of the architecture, but it's featured in so many films, so if you want to do like YouTube search for like Sherman Oaks Galleria. But what they have now... It is more pedestrian friendly, but it's pretty bland.
It's pretty bland, and also the mall itself is always almost completely empty, so it's a little sad. I think that the only thing that's really worthwhile there now is the Arclight Theater.
So you referenced a number of old 80s films that take place in the Valley.
Yeah, just a couple of them kind of came to my mind during my photo essay. Chiefly the original Karate Kid movie and Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Oh, yeah. I forget the name of the actress who starred in that, but she's also like a blonde Jewish girl. Like she's definitely up there with like Alicia Silverstone.
Yeah,
Do you know the actress I'm talking about?
Jesse something? I can look it up real quick. Like... two names that start with J. Hold on a second. Let me look it up. Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Oh, right.
Yeah, there's those two movies. There's also a lot of good Paul Thomas Anderson movies from the 90s that were filmed in the Valley. Magnolia and Boogie Nights. Have you seen those?
A really long time ago.
Yeah, those are interesting films.
Yeah, I've seen Boogie Nights. I didn't know it was filmed in the Valley. One film that was filmed in the Valley, which is kind of... I guess it does tie into what we're talking about, is did you see the show I did with Count Fosco on Blast from the Past with Alicia Silverstone and Brendan Fraser?
No, unfortunately, nor have I seen that movie.
So Brendan Fraser is living in the Valley in the 1950s, and they go into a fallout shelter, and then he comes out in the present, which is the late 90s, and he thinks that the Valley is like turned into like a zombie apocalypse. It's some area like, it's probably like Van Nuys or North Hollywood.
Yeah, well, it kind of looks like that in some parts. But, yeah, there's actually this... I almost linked this on my photo blog, but there's this movie from the 70s actually called Van Nuys Boulevard, which was like this really silly-looking but like softcore porn movie about car culture. Because apparently that used to be a big thing on Van Nuys Boulevard. as is reflected in some of the kind of worn and beaten down car dealerships I put in my blog.
Yeah, and I mean, if you go beyond Van Nuys, like that whole area, Panorama City, Pacoima, I mean, that's pretty much as bad as, like, East LA.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, just the... You really do feel kind of like you're walking through a graveyard in certain parts.
But the significance of a lot of those films is people from other parts of the country, like the East Coast, they watched those films and they saw this kind of idealized middle-class suburban lifestyle. And that was sort of a time when a lot of people still wanted to move to L.A. I mean, people do, but Americans of, like, a middle-class background.
Yeah, yeah, definitely, you know, the middle-class background thing. I've heard the Valley in the 80s and probably in the 70s as well described as kind of America's suburb, quote-unquote, because it really, with the amount of really famous movies that were filmed there, like The Karate Kid, it really kind of defined a cultural moment of middle-class America. A lot, so many, like, cultural reference points, you know, like the Valley Girl, for instance, came out of there, and, like, 80s mall culture, so related to the Sherman Oaks Galleria, because that's what people saw on the screen.
So with the Valley, is you recently moved to L.A. from Philadelphia.
That's right, yep.
You're living in the Valley, and traditionally the Valley was where the white middle class lived, and those people basically all moved out into Santa Clarita, which is just all these subdivisions. And the San Fernando Valley has the main area is, the main section is Ventura Boulevard, which is it's a nice area. It is. It's semi-urban, it's walkable, it's fairly upscale, and then to the south of that you have a lot of wealthy areas up in the hills, but the majority of the Valley is just kind of these areas that are, they used to be these 1950s suburban areas, but it's mostly like a lower class area, places like Van Nuys, which I think you took some photographs of Van Nuys.
Yeah, Van Nuys Boulevard. I mean, a lot of these areas are like graveyards. Which kind of plays into the idea of the hauntological aesthetic that I kind of talk about in some of my blog posts. I mean, these are places that are definitely haunted by, you know, previous occupants, but now populated almost entirely by immigrants. I mean, basically the way the Valley works, as you kind of alluded to, is you have Ventura Boulevard, which is fairly upscale, running up the entire west side, and then kind of nice neighborhoods immediately surrounding it, and then it drops off really quickly.
Yeah, you basically go from like an upper middle class area to a ghetto to lower middle class area, and you completely skip the middle. And that kind of reflects this sort of overall trend in society. I mean, the middle class are in Santa Clarita, but if things get really bad, maybe Santa Clarita will follow that route. Who knows?
Probably. I'm actually reminded, I think this is a lovely quote, or it's kind of terrifying, actually, but the English kind of cyberpunk author, J.G. Ballard, I don't know where this quote's from, but he once described the future as the Californianization of everything, or perhaps you might even say the Californication of everything. And I think what is kind of happening in California and L.A.
So the Californication of everything will be everyone taking orders and doing sexual favors for Succolini?
Yeah, well, that would be femdom nationalism, wouldn't it? So I don't know if that's what it's going to be. But yeah, I mean, this kind of stark income inequality where it's, you know, basically gated communities right next to populations of immigrants with no middle class is definitely what I see in the Valley and in L.A. more broadly. And kind of, I think, the what the end result would be of this kind of conspiracy between social leftism, liberal universalism, and global capitalism.
Yeah, the coalition of liberalism and capitalism, Because if you follow liberals in the news right now, you don't hear them complaining about, like, income inequality or the downtrodden working class. Everything they're ranting about is this whole hysteria that, like, Trump is too mean towards, like, illegal immigrants. And
yeah, it is, it is a hysteria.
Yeah, but the problem is there, some of those leftists or liberals might be well-meaning, but they're responsible for creating these kind of societies like you have in L.A. and the San Fernando Valley.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, I come from a very leftist background. I study a lot of Antonio Gramsci on cultural hegemony in college, and the basic idea there is that system, structures of power, you know, take cultural ideas and use them as a moral veneer to justify what they do. And I really pretty strongly believe that you know, Americanism, or what Americanism has become since the 80s and then the Reagan 80s and the Clinton 90s, is this kind of global capitalism with a liberal universalist moral veneer.
So yeah, that's kind of what we have to do, is create a successful alternative to it. And all these different dissident movements have tried, and they've come short. I think your whole kind of what I've been doing and what you're talking about is just creating, instead of just talking about politics, just kind of create this image of this idealized utopian society that people want to live in, and that can include the aesthetics and more practical aspects, and that will draw people. And even people who are more liberal will see, like, yeah, that sounds like a kind of society I'd want to live in.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need vision more than we need, you know, good arguments. And I don't know if that sounds bad. But I think, yeah, we need vision and visionary people, a kind of aristocratic elitism.
Yeah, you kind of need to have that kind of a class of aristocratic radicals as a ruling class, as opposed to these kind of the liberal capitalist class.
Yeah, pretty much is what I would argue.
I think I forget who it was, but someone coined our elites as like sociopathic social Darwinists posing as like liberal humanitarians.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of sounds like, was that Giovanni Donato?
It might have been Greg Johnson, yeah. But I'm not 100% sure.
Oh, or Greg Johnson, yeah. Someone smart. But that definitely is the kind of view that I've found myself holding.
We're getting close to the end of the show. You are planning your first trip to the San Francisco Bay Area, so hopefully that will give you a lot of information, a lot of inspiration for articles and photo journals.
Definitely. I'm hoping to get some of that up. I'm hoping to do more photo journals and kind of bring things in that direction for my blog.
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of that lately.
Yeah, I think it's a really good thing.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Matt for being on. It's been an excellent show.
Thanks, Robert. Thanks again for having me.